If America is a melting pot, then at the center of that melting pot is the Northeast. I know geographically that doesn't make sense, but you understand. It is here that people come from all over the world, and they settle in, and our area is the area where so many of them come. Our own church is evidence of that, that we have people from all over the world who are part of our church family. And in this community in Westchester County and New York City, you see the influences not just of cultures, but of religions. Drive down the street and you'll definitely see a cathedral or church, perhaps a synagogue. And more you'll see mosques around. The influence of religion is felt even in our fairly secular culture. We live in an age where we've kind of moved away from religion a little bit. And yet when you think about it, it is those religious things that have a way of shaping us. I mean, they shape what we call the special holidays that we celebrate. They separate us out in how we celebrate some of those holidays. They can even influence who we marry. They can influence when we worship, where we worship. All those things are part of our religion. And here, as we come together on Easter Sunday, we celebrate the biggest Christian holiday. Now, granted, if you've spent any time in the United States, you know that we make a bigger deal probably out of Christmas. But that's really not the bigger Christian holiday. It's the bigger holiday for the retailers, and so they promote it from Halloween on through the end of December. But on Sunday morning, Easter Sunday, that's when the churches are filled. Because Easter is an influential holiday. And very influential for us who are followers of Jesus Christ. But have you ever wondered what would happen if you had to create some kind of religion? If it were up to you to start your own religion to influence people? We kind of take for granted the influence of Christianity and the influence of religion in our society. But obviously the religions that so shape us really haven't done that forever. What would you do if you wanted to start your own religion? I suppose you might start by coming up with some sort of religious treatise, some theological statements, and write them down and sell them, teach them, instruct them to people around you, and get them to buy in. And as they buy in and they believe it, then they would follow your beliefs and your religion. There are a lot of people who think that's how Christianity got started. We live in a culture that's very information-oriented, and on a Sunday morning, the pastor stands up with a Bible and preaches from it, or you turn on the radio and you hear radio preachers or television preachers, and it's a communication about the Bible. But the truth is, Christianity did not begin with a written word. The Bible as we have it, the New Testament as we have it, really wasn't fully accepted by the church until about 400 years after the time of Jesus. So it wasn't the New Testament scriptures as we have them that started Christianity. It was something else. So if you wanted to start your own religion, how would you do it? Now, if you didn't do it by having some sort of religious treatise, some sort of theological statement, it seems to me that another way that we might try to get some buy-in to our new religion is to find people of influence. You find influencers who will influence others so that people who respect them will follow them and they'll buy into the religion that we sell. And so it would make sense that if we're trying to start this religion, we would find some of the most influential people and the people who are perhaps some of the thinkers and the shapers and the shakers and the movers of society. It's interesting, once again, if we think that way And it makes sense to us that that's not how Christianity started. Oh, it's easy for us in the 21st century, so far separated from the time of Jesus, to exalt the followers of Jesus and make them something they were not. I mean, it's easy to think of the disciples as walking around with little halos over their heads and being particularly holy and devout and wise people. But if you read through the Bible, you discover that's not the picture that we have of the disciples. They weren't particularly devout. They weren't particularly well educated. In fact, you know, when you look at that crew, quite a few of them were just fishermen. And then there was Simon, not the fisherman Simon Peter, but Simon the Zealot. You know, zealots were those people who were opposed to the Roman rule. They wanted to see the Jews overthrow the Romans. So there was this zealous disciple. And then there was in Jesus' entourage, Matthew, a tax collector. And if the zealot was known for being loyal to the Jews, an anti-Roman, Matthew would have been known as being a sellout to the Romans, an anti-Jewish almost. And all these people were all part of Jesus' entourage. They weren't really particularly impressive people. And yet, this is how Christianity began. It's interesting, over in Acts chapter 4, you discover that at the very beginning of, before the church has even started, there are two of Jesus' disciples, John and Peter. And in the first three verses of Acts chapter 4, Luke writes, "The priests and the captain of the temple guard and the Sadducees came up to Peter and John while they were speaking to the people. They were greatly disturbed because the apostles were teaching the people and proclaiming in Jesus the resurrection of the dead. They seized Peter and John, and because it was evening, they put them in jail until the next day." Now, you might think that the reason that Christianity spread was because of the persuasiveness of Peter and John. And it's hard to argue against that. Certainly, they were persuasive at that moment, but to know them when they were followers of Jesus was not to be all that impressed with them. In fact, a little bit later on in Acts chapter 4, I think it's verse 13, it says that the leaders of the Jews, when they heard what these people were saying, they took note that these were just unschooled and ordinary men. There wasn't anything particularly impressive about those who were the followers of Jesus. And yet they managed to spread this new religion. Among those followers, we know there were women. In the story we read, the Easter story, the first witnesses of the resurrection were women. And yet in that culture, in that day, unliberated as it was, women didn't have much standing. They wouldn't be trusted as witnesses in a court of law. And yet, they were the ones that Jesus first appeared to. Now, in that day, the Jews would pray publicly, "Lord, I thank you that I am not a Gentile or a woman." And yet, among Jesus' entourage were not only fishermen, zealots, tax collectors, but women. So how is it that with this ordinary bunch of people that Christianity got started? Well, again, it's pretty amazing when you think about it, because it wasn't an easy thing to start. To begin with, the disciples of Jesus were not out to start a new religion. I'm convinced that they were simply trying to promote Judaism, to tell the world about their Jewish Messiah. It wasn't their desire to break from Judaism. I think that's why in Acts chapter 4, you find them standing in the Jewish temple courts proclaiming this news about Jesus. It was never their desire to start a new religion. They wanted to progress Judaism, to say that the Old Testament Messiah has come, and his name is none other than Jesus. But to proclaim that was to invite persecution. Wherever Peter or John or any of the other disciples went, they faced being outcast. They faced being beaten and abused and imprisoned and sometimes even killed. I want you to imagine for a moment that the disciples decide about 20, 25 years after Jesus has died that they're going to have a reunion of the old gang, the 12 disciples. Now, it's been 20, 25 years, been a little while. And so the first thing you have to do to get a reunion together is you've got to send out invitations. So, you know, who do you get to send out the invitations? Well, of course, it makes sense. You might get Matthew and John. They're the writers, you know, so we'll get them to send out the invitations. And then, of course, you got to find out where everybody's at. And so they send out the invitations as best they can, and they gather in that same upper room. And it's funny how even after 20, 25 years, everybody kind of sits in the same place. And Matthew's seated where he normally sits, and John. And there's good old Bartholomew. You can always count on him. And Thaddeus, you can set your sundial by Thaddeus. But there's a rumor that Philip's been imprisoned in Asia Minor. And, of course, they've had to replace Judas Iscariot. They'd find out where Matthias was. He's the new guy. And so some of these people are there, but there are some empty spots. No one's exactly sure what happened to Thomas. He supposedly went off to India, but no one's heard anything from him. Andrew shows up to the meeting a little bit late, and he walks in, and a sad smile comes across his face. These guys, some of them he hasn't seen for 20 years. And they don't look quite like the same strapping bunch of men that Jesus had recruited a couple decades before. Now he looks at them, and all of them have some gray in their hair. John's hairline is receding very noticeably. And he can't help but notice they're stooped and they're beaten. They just don't look like the same guys that he knew. And he says, "Guys, where's James? I don't see James." And John begins to answer, but before he can answer, Peter says, "He's dead. Hadn't you heard? He was executed by Herod 6 months ago. I guess I should have told you when I sent out the invitations." Before anybody else can interject anything, Peter says, "Look, guys, this is not working. I mean, this is not working. It's not what I signed up for 20 years ago. It was fun back then. We had a purpose then, but that was before we were beaten and we were persecuted. That was before we were excommunicated from the synagogues. That was before we were whipped and thrown in jail. This just isn't fun anymore. And guys, I for one want to quit." Could you blame them if that had happened? I mean, because that's the lot that the disciples faced for trying to promote their belief in Jesus. So how is it then, if that was what the followers of Jesus faced, how is it that we're here today on Easter Sunday in a full church celebrating the resurrection of Jesus? Well, that is exactly why Christianity continued. Because these disciples became convinced of a reality that totally changed their lives. It was not a reality that they expected. They should have, mind you, but they didn't. They were not expecting Jesus to rise from the dead. Now, if the disciples expected Jesus to do something, my guess is they expected him to do it before he was arrested in the garden. They might have expected it on that Palm Sunday when Jesus rode into Jerusalem. They may have been a little disappointed that he did it on a colt, but they might have thought, this is going to be the place, this is going to be the time, now he's going to start things up. But he didn't. And if they held out hope that maybe Jesus was going to do something, you would assume that perhaps when the soldiers came to arrest Jesus in the garden, that he would have put up a fight. I mean, after all, Peter grabbed his sword and swung wildly and managed to cut off somebody's ear. Maybe Jesus could have made something happen there. But he didn't. And I suppose if they held out any hope that somehow Jesus would do something significant, maybe it's when he was being tried before Pilate. And he's being asked, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus said yes, but he didn't say much more. Now the disciples had to be frustrated with Jesus. They had to be confused, not knowing what was going on. And when they nailed Jesus to that cross, if they had any hope at all, it was before that spear was thrust in his side and before he breathed his last. But when Jesus was dead upon that cross, all their hopes and all their dreams died too. I suspect that even when Jesus was being nailed to the cross, one or two of those disciples may have been like the little boy listening to the baseball game, and even though his team is behind by 10 runs in the ninth inning, he thinks, there's still hope. There's still some hope. They can come back from this. But when they took Jesus' body down from the cross and they put it in a tomb, they knew the game was over. They knew there was no hope. They were not expecting anything more. And yet the message that they proclaimed in the temple courts that we read a moment ago was that there is resurrection. That Jesus Christ rose from the dead. And that's what changed the disciples. It wasn't something that they were hoping for, wishing for. It was something that totally shocked them. Totally surprised them. They knew that the game was over. The score was final. But what they didn't know was the game had only begun. Because Jesus rose from the dead. And he appeared to them and he amazed them that he wasn't dead in the tomb, that he was alive. And that truth is what changed everything for the disciples. It was that truth that caused them to go from people who had deserted him, had turned their backs on him, had been afraid to stand up for him, to be these people who stood in the temple courts and said, Jesus is the Messiah. He died and he rose again from the dead. Think about how that news changed them. Because the reality is, anytime a person embraces the truth that Jesus rose from the dead, they're changed by that. I mean, Peter. I don't know how you think about Peter, but certainly, it didn't look particularly good for Peter on that night that Jesus was being tried. You know how it was. He was there in Caiaphas's court, and Peter was in the shadows watching. And there somebody saw him there in the shadows, and they said, I know you. You're one of his disciples. You're one of his disciples, aren't you? Remember? I am not. And then a little bit later, he was warming himself by the fire, and there were some people standing around the fire, and they said, we know you. You're one of his disciples. He said, I am not. And then a little later, he's still in the shadows. And there was somebody who'd been there in the garden, and they'd seen what Peter had done with his sword. He said, you're the one. You were in the garden. He says, I was not. I was not. What was it that changed Peter from that timid denier? It was the resurrection. That's why when he went to the tomb, he went inside, but he wasn't the one who immediately believed. It wasn't easy for Peter to believe. It took the appearance of the resurrected Christ to change him. I mean, think about those men on the road to Emmaus. Remember, they were walking along, and Jesus walked along with them. They didn't even recognize them. Why was that? Because they didn't expect Jesus to be raised from the dead. But any time someone embraces the reality that Jesus, the Savior, is alive, it changes them. That was true for Thomas. Remember, Thomas gets such a bad rap, but he is so much like us. You know, we know him as the doubting disciple. But would you have been any different than Thomas? I mean, imagine that all of us had been to a funeral on Friday. Somebody you loved had died. You were there. You saw them put that person in the ground. And now on Sunday, you come to church and all your friends are saying, guess what? Guess what? He's alive. No, he's alive. Would you immediately say, you must be right. Of course, I agree. We wouldn't do that. And neither could Thomas. In fact, Thomas said, you know, I don't know what you guys have been drinking or smoking, but I can't buy that. He said, unless I can put my fingers in his nail-pierced hands, unless I can put my hand in his side, I will not believe. He may be known as the doubting disciple, but I appreciate him. Because that's how I would have been. I mean, dead men don't rise. Except Peter saw Jesus alive. And Thomas, he was there with the disciples, remember, in that upper room? And he wasn't going to believe. He couldn't, in good conscience, believe. As much as he wanted to believe, he just couldn't do that. But all of a sudden, Jesus walked into that room. He walked through the walls as if they were nothing. And he shows up and he holds out his hands. He says, Thomas, it's I. Here, look. Stop doubting and believe. Remember? Thomas, seeing the resurrected Christ, unable to deny it any longer, falls on his knees. He says, my Lord and my God. Whenever people embrace the reality that Jesus is alive from the dead, they're changed. They have hope. They have substance for their faith. It was true of the Apostle Paul. Paul wasn't even one of the original disciples. In fact, Paul was a devout Jew who sought to destroy Christianity. He saw it as a sect that was going to undermine Judaism. And so it was his goal, his passion, his mission statement in life to wipe out those people. And if you remember, he was on his way to Damascus to do that very thing. He'd heard there was a gathering there and he was going to do whatever it took to destroy them. Except while he was on his way to Damascus, he had an encounter. An encounter with Jesus. The resurrected Christ showed up to Paul, and he could have no doubts. He calls out, remember, who are you, Lord? And Jesus says, I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting. And from that moment on, Paul ceases to be the opponent of the church and becomes the proponent of the church. He ceases to be persecuting the church, and he is persecuted as a member of the church. Ultimately, the Apostle Paul was persecuted and probably beheaded in Rome. In fact, when you read the history, you discover that 10 of the 12 disciples all died martyrs' deaths, proclaiming that they had seen Jesus Christ alive from the dead. Now, when people embrace the truth that this isn't just a feel-good story, this is a reality, it changes everything. It changed the disciples. And it's amazing. Thomas, that one who was a doubter, he left and became a missionary to India. He spread the news of Jesus to the people there. Paul, the persecutor, went to spread the church in the rest of the world. When people are convinced of the truth that Jesus, who died, has risen, it changes them. And that's still true today. Back in the 1960s, there was a man by the name of Frank Morrison. Frank Morrison was an attorney, and he was a skeptic. He was from the United States, had heard the stories about Jesus, but thought, this is just religious stuff. And so he decided that he would investigate it, and he would write kind of the authoritative, definitive work, and that he would debunk Christianity once and for all. And yet, when you read Frank Morrison's book, Who Moved the Stone, the first chapter of that book is entitled, The Book That Refused to be Written. Because as Morrison began to study the facts of the biblical accounts and the changes in the disciples and the explanations, he came to believe it for himself. And he wrote the book, Who Moved the Stone, as evidence for the resurrection. In the 1970s, there was a man by the name of Josh McDowell. He too was either agnostic or atheist. I'm not sure which, but he wasn't a believer. And he set out to disprove Christianity, and he decided to put the pieces together. And you're probably familiar with Josh McDowell as the one who wrote the book, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. Because after he looked at it, he was changed by what he saw. And he wrote a book that's an apologetic for the resurrection and for the truth of Jesus. More recently, in the 1990s, there was a fellow by the name of Lee Strobel. Lee Strobel was the editor of the legal section of the Chicago Tribune. And Lee Strobel, his wife was an agnostic. He was an atheist. And he was kind of surprised by her because she embraced Jesus as her Savior. And he saw this difference in her life, and it kind of bothered him, frankly. And so he decided, you know, he would try to help her out and everyone like her, and he would write another book. And he would convince her and convince everyone of the truth. But you may know that he wrote a book called The Case for Christ, a New York Times bestseller, underscoring that there is validity to the resurrection of Jesus. The point I'm making is Christianity is really ultimately not primarily a religion. It's not ultimately a religious treatise. It is Jesus. It's about who he is. And the disciples, their message was to say that Jesus, who died, is alive from the dead. This one who died on a cross is not still dead. He is alive. And his death is not like any other figure. Other religious figures have died. But to my knowledge, they're still dead. But Jesus, the message of Christianity is not just that Jesus died on a cross, but that 3 days later he rose from the dead. So he didn't just die a martyr's death, he died a sacrificial death. That means that what he did on the cross made a difference for his disciples. It makes a difference for you and me. If we embrace it, we realize that he died in our place. He paid for our sin. And the way we can be sure of that is that he's not still dead. He is unique in all of history. And it was that that changed the disciples. And it is that that has changed men and women throughout all of history. When people embrace the reality that Jesus is alive, they're changed by that. So my question is, what about you? What's happening in your life? I know some of you came here and you're firm believers in Jesus. Well, the message of Easter then is a message that there is substance. There is hope. We don't live as people who are hopeless. The Apostle Paul wrote to the Corinthians, he said, if we have only in this life to hope, we are of all people most to be pitied. The hope of Christianity is there's more to life than just the here and now. And we can plant our flag on that and live for more than just the here and now. And maybe you're here because your spouse dragged you to church on Easter Sunday. And maybe you're here as a bit of a skeptic yourself. My challenge to you is to do what Frank Morrison did. To do what Josh McDowell did, to do what Lee Strobel did, do what a bunch of other people have done, and investigate the truth for yourself. Because I think you'll discover, as I've discovered, that there is substance to Jesus' claims. He's not just a religious figure. He is the risen Lord who died for you. And all you need to do, if you recognize that fact, is just trust him to realize he didn't die a martyr's death. He died a sacrificial death in your place for you. And that you can have a new relationship with God simply by trusting in that. That's what Easter's all about. We're really not all that concerned about starting religions. Easter really is about a relationship with a living Savior. Do you know him? Maybe this Easter is your opportunity to begin life anew with God.